today is the question of preparedness and prevention. So we know we're going to continue to ship oil, so we don't do this again. And I was struck by your remarks and your testimony, and I quote you, and I'm quoting your written rather than your spoken, that you're satisfied that this country's national response organization is working well, qualified by the severity of the spill and the remoteness of the area. I think that those qualifications are not appropriate because we do have major tankers. We have to cope with that, and they are capable of major spills, and we also have many remote areas where those tankers operate, so I think we have to treat those as routine rather than spectacular. I listened to your comments and the testimony of others that perhaps the booming could have been done faster, that perhaps
it was ridiculous that some mariner may be attempting to navigate the waters between Bligh Reef and Reef Island. If I may,
and the testimony of others, that
there used to be a ship that went right through here.
It's ridiculous
during the old steamship days.
Mariner
and the speculation among the townsfolk in Valdez was that is, of course, exactly what was going on. That
it would, in fact, take a cowboy to some degree to attempt something like this. It's purely speculative on the part of anyone who would make that assertion. But as the as Admiral Yost indicated, it's absolutely inexplicable that a trained mariner could put a super tanker up on that reef. That reef is perhaps the most notorious hazard in all of Prince William Sound. I used to fish in those waters. I lived in Valdez. I am John's predecessor as the mayor of Valdez prior to becoming lieutenant governor. There isn't a kid in that town that borrows a motorboat from his dad that doesn't know that Bligh Reef is there and what dangers it would pose to a ship the size of the Exxon Valdez. It is totally unbelievable that that ship hit that reef. Now, having said that, we have, over the past several years, dealt with Alyeska Pipeline Service Company as well as the owner companies. And time and time again, we have been told that there very probably wouldn't be a spill of this magnitude. In fact, members of this very committee have no doubt been told the same thing. The Admiral indicated that that they had not ever been prepared to address a spill the size of a spill that was incurred in Prince William Sound on March 24th. I'm holding in front of me a Prince William Town tanker casualty asking Alyeska Pipeline Service Company to respond to a scenario of a spill in Prince William Sound in the amount of 200,000 barrels. Recall that this particular spill is 240,000 barrels. The response begins immediately that it is Alyeska Pipeline Service Company believes it is highly unlikely a spill of this magnitude would occur. Catastrophic events of this nature are further reduced because the majority of tankers calling on Port Valdez are of American registry, and all of these are piloted by licensed masters or pilots. That is their opening salvo as to why they probably needn't even address this. Let me indicate to the committee that the state of Alaska is very, very unhappy. We are extremely unhappy with the promises that were made and the promises by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company that appear to have been broken. Now, Alyeska says that they followed the contingency response exactly as it was set out. And I dare say, ladies and gentlemen, if I was looking down both barrels of a major lawsuit and the liability that this entails, I think that I would probably be singing that same song. Many of us who went to the site, many of us who saw what occurred on that day, saw the response that was made to it, or the lack thereof, cannot concur in that position. The response was very little. The response in every oil spill contingency plan requires that they first contain the oil. Even this scenario sets out sending booms and vessels to contain the oil. There was no attempt to made to contain the oil for more than 35 hours after the oil hit the water. I met with Admiral Nelson, who is the area commander. I met with Commander McCall, who's the on-site commander, Coast Guard commander. I met with Mr. Iarossi, who has the responsibility for Exxon for the cleanup project, and together with some other individuals. And I posed the question to Mr. Iarossi, why wasn't the ship boomed? And the response was that even if we had the opportunity to make that decision today, and we're talking on Sunday night, after three full days of ideal weather, flat, calm conditions, perfect for the mechanical recovery of oil, and conditions, by the way, which rarely exist in the springtime in Prince William Sound, he said that if I had that decision to make now, I may not even make it now. And I asked him why, because obviously they had not boomed the ship for several hours after this spill. And he said his concern was that they would get all of those hydrocarbons in the same location and the fumes going off, that they may end up with an explosion. Well, 2 months ago, a ship was in Port Valdez, and it began to leak. And the first thing that they did was they boomed the vessel. And they managed to recover all of the oil, or the vast majority of the oil, that leaked from that vessel. And they took what could have been a tragic incident for the oil companies, predating this incident by some 2 months, and turned it into a fairly good PR stroke, because they were able to say, we do have the capability to meet these types of situations, and we do have the capability to respond in an adequate fashion. I have absolutely no idea why the vessel wasn't similarly boomed in this particular instance. But always it's been the position of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, always it has been the position of the oil companies, always it has been the position of the state of Alaska, that the first, the primary, and the best method of recovery of oil is from the surface of the water, taking it out of the water and disposing of it at a later point in time. It appears that, at least in the scenario that's presented for the 200,000-barrel spill, at least some utilization of dispersants is going to be required. And there is a pre-approval, as the Admiral indicated, for Zone 1 utilization of dispersants. In my meeting with Mr. Iorosi, I asked the question, why haven't dispersants been used heretofore? And remember, we're talking, it's late Sunday night. It's around midnight into Sunday, Monday. And he said that even if we had permission to use the dispersants, they couldn't have used them because of the flat, calm conditions. They need the turbulence of the water in order to allow the dispersants to mix with the oil. And that they had received permission late Saturday to go ahead with an operation beginning Monday morning because the winds were going to change. And of course, the winds did change that night. They blew at some 70 miles an hour. And the next morning, some official said to me, it's really tragic that the weather conditions have shifted to the degree that they have. And I turned and I said, sir, what you're witnessing right now is typical weather in the springtime in Valdez, Alaska. What you've had pass you by is an absolutely perfect 3 days of grace in which you could have engaged in a fairly major cleanup operation and got some of that oil off the water. Let me conclude my opening by just saying one thing, and that is expressing the mood of the people of Valdez, Alaska, a community that you could have pulled 5 years ago, and they would have said, shown 92% favorable disposition to the oil companies and to the operation there. The one word that I heard more than any other word when I was home was betrayal. We've been betrayed. And ladies and gentlemen, as policymakers in this nation, certainly as policymakers in our state and policymakers at the local level, we are going to have to take the trust that we've held heretofore away and begin to undertake the action ourselves. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear here before you today.
Ladies and gentlemen, as policymakers, thank you, Governor. I will now recognize the mayor of the city of Valdez, Mayor Divins.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity to speak before this committee. I also appreciate the very sympathetic comments that members of this committee have made. We are very upset by the things that have happened to us. I do want to thank and mention the congressman from Washington. I think that he best summarized what is most on our minds right now. We're not trying to place blame. That's somebody else's job, and that'll be taken care of as we get into this. But right now, we have people that are suffering, and they're suffering greatly, and we need some help. And we're calling on the federal government to try and provide us with some help. We appreciate the fact that there have been individuals from Washington that have been sent to Alaska, but we hope that the message that they bring back, that this is truly a disaster. Had this same disaster occurred off from Long Island or off from L.A. or San Francisco, I guarantee you that a declaration of disaster would have been called, but it happened in Alaska, and we didn't get the declaration of disaster, and we need it. We need some help for the people that are going to be suffering in Alaska, the fishermen, the business communities that are not going to have the income this year. We're going to have people that are going to be losing their boats because they will not have the fisheries income. We know that Exxon has agreed to settle all reasonable claims, but how soon will those claims be settled? We need some low-interest loans in Alaska that will allow these people to hang on until the settlement is made. We really need this from you very desperately. Valdez is a community of 3,600 people on a year-round basis. Our population goes up during the summertime because of fisheries and because of tourism. We have for a number of years recognized the finite nature of the oil industry. The day will come when the oil will run out. We have tried to develop other industries to take the place of the income that we've had from the oil industry when it runs out. The income that we have tried to develop is in the area of tourism and fisheries. This is a disaster to us. 25% of the nation's oil comes from this small community that's been referred to as very remote rural Alaska. We've always supported the oil industry. We'll continue to support the oil industry, but we want some regulations and some restraints placed on this. We want the oil industry to live up to their responsibility to us right now. We're concerned about our neighboring communities, Cordova, Alaska. Is a fishing community. They are devastated by this. I spoke with their mayor just before I came, Erling Johansson. He was emotional. He was shaken to the quick because his community will be destroyed by what's happening here. We have the two native communities, Tetitlik and Chiniga. Their entire way of life, their culture, could be destroyed by what is happening here. Whittier, Seward, Homer, Kenai, and Kenai Borough are all going to be affected because of their income. The Mayor's Conference of Alaska met during all of this. They are asking for a task force to be formed to look into this. I have comments that I was going to read, but I don't think time allows, from the other mayors of the communities that are affected. But we're all concerned, and we're primarily concerned because of the economic impact that we're facing. We've been talking about, I heard the Coast Guard refer to how we're trying to protect the sensitive areas of Alaska. Right now you have 800 miles of sensitive area that has been impacted by this. You've all seen the videos that have been on television. I've brought pictures that I think most of you have. We've passed out, I don't know, upwards towards about 30 of these pictures. These pictures were taken approximately 15 hours after the incident. I think if you look at the pictures, you'll notice in these pictures, 15 hours after this incident occurred, you see no booming. You see no other ships in the vicinity, except in this one you'll see that the Exxon Baton Rouge is now pulling into line to try and get over and do some lightering. That was 15 hours after. Had we taken these same pictures 3 days after, they would have changed very little. There was very little done during the first 3 days. Lieutenant Governor McAlpine spoke to this just a moment ago. We wasted three excellent days in Prince William Sound when some mechanical pickup could have been accomplished. Now, the excuses that are given is that we didn't have the skimmers available. Well, I remind you that skimmers are available elsewhere. Why doesn't the oil industry have skimmers available in one of the most sensitive areas in the world? I'll conclude my remarks by summarizing. If you really want to help Alaska right now, our communities desperately need some federal assistance. We need some low-interest loans, somebody to cover us until our businesses can settle with the Exxon company. We want this cleanup accomplished. I hold that 4% of the oil has been picked up. That's pathetically poor. Our beaches are inundated. We have thousands of birds and animals that have died in this, and we need some help, and we need someone to put the pressure on and get this done. And finally, and I know this is primarily the interest of this committee, but standards have to be developed. We've got to have some protection. And I don't know that we can have the trust that we've always had in the past that industry is going to take care of us. I think government has to be ready to respond to these kinds of spills. We cannot afford to have this happen again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mayor. And if you have additional statements from other mayors, they will readily be made a part of the record upon submission, and that will be without objection if you will kindly provide those to our staff.
I will. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mayor. Gentlemen, if you would make room, perhaps, we'll now invite the Secretary of Transportation, who has arrived from his Joseph Conrad trip to the Senate. And we now welcome our new Secretary of Transportation, Mr. Samuel Skinner. Mr. Secretary, we're pleased to have you here today. We know, again, these are trying times for you in the new administration of transportation. This is your first appearance before our committee, and we wish that we were on better times and occasions than this, but we welcome you. And we invite
you. We're pleased to have you here today. We know, again, that these are trying times for you and the new
plant workers and their families worrying about their future, my constituents out there worrying about how the losses of fish and habitat will affect the future, their future. I join them in seeking answers and pressing for action. Mr. Chairman, this disaster should not have happened. We should have done more when it happened, and we cannot let it happen again. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Matten.
Will affect the future. Their future. I join them in
seeking
answers and pressing for action. Mr. Chairman, this disaster should not have happened. We should have done more.
Regarding the massive well spill in Prince William Sound, let me simply say that I am shocked,
Mr. Matt.
I am saddened, and I am angry. Shocked, Mr. Chairman, through the Alyeska Pipeline Company, the Exxon Corporation, the Coast Guard, and the state of Alaska all failed to keep their promise to the American people that a spill of this nature would not be permitted to occur in the waters near the southern end of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. What is so shocking is that this ecological disaster was eminently preventable, and yet it was allowed to occur. Once it occurred, the parties responsible, primarily Exxon and Alyeska, were not prepared and apparently were not cooperative concerning the severe ecological and economic consequences of the ruptured tanker spilling millions of gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound. I'm saddened, Mr. Chairman, because this spill has brought terrible damage to the hundreds of species of marine life living in the sound and along the sounding islands. It's brought death and destruction to the area's profitable and important fishing industry and has sullied one of the most beautiful spots on the North American continent. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I'm angry. I'm angry because irresponsible actions of Exxon and Alyeska have put in peril the billions of barrels of oil lying beneath the coastal plain of Alaska's northern shore. This oil is vital to our nation's future economic health and our national security. It is also vital to our domestic shipping industry and our manufacturing base in the lower 48 states. We can adopt measures to increase the fuel efficiency, we can adopt measures to increase conservation, we can promote alternative sources of energy, yet in the end, we will still need the oil on Alaska's North Shore to fuel our economy, lessen our foreign trade deficit, and prevent a return to the economic and political leverage Middle Eastern nations exercised over this country as they did during the years following the Arab oil embargo and the Iranian Revolution. Ironically, Mr. Chairman, Exxon and Alyeska, two of the biggest beneficiaries of our need for this North Slope oil, have acted in a manner which may prevent this resource from being fully realized by our nation. If this imperilment was the result of an unavoidable circumstance, then maybe I would just be shocked and saddened. But given the facts, as I understand them, I'm angry, and the American people are angry, and they have every right to be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Gentleman is recognized. Proceed, Mr. Chairman.
I only want to say that I believe you in your opening remarks and the ranking member both said it, and I want to make sure everybody understands it. This is a tragic thing that happened. And as I understand, and we'll find out more today, Exxon has assumed the responsibility. Disciplinary action is being taken. But we can't lose sight of the fact that what the real mission here today is to prevent and to respond in the event it happens in the future. While it's an economic and an environmental tragedy that took place, a far greater tragedy would occur if this were used to retard our exploration and production activities in both the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the Outer Continental Shelf. At a time when we are teetering on the 50% dependency on foreign oil for our very existence and our nation's security, we can't allow this to happen. So I hope that we can focus on the problem as it exists, one of transportation, and not let it impair our ability to become energy self-sufficient.
Thank you, Mr. Inhofe. Gentleman from Maine, Mr. Brennan, recognized. We can't allow
this. I hope that we can focus. People in the United States and the world learn again of the consequences of alcohol abuse, the massive destruction of the environment and wildlife. I think we also learn again of the responsibility of top officials of companies like Exxon who have policies in place that ensure that their ships are not operated by drunken captains. Right now, the policies need to be the health of the public, the health of the environment. I say that the news accounts have clearly indicated that there was more than ample evidence for a company like Exxon to have taken action to make sure that somebody wasn't operating this ship, didn't have a responsibility to operate that ship under the influence of alcohol. Yes, we all have a deep responsibility to Congress, the executive branch, and industry to make sure that something like this doesn't occur again. In view of this gentleman's record, it was absolutely appalling that a company like Exxon would let him operate that ship.
Thank you, sir. Her opening statements has now expired unless there is some subcommittee member who insists. Then the chair is pleased to welcome our first witness, the Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Admiral Paul Yost. Admiral Yost.
Thank you very much, and good morning, Mr. Chairman. Accompanying me today are the Vice Commandant, Vice Admiral Clyde Lusk, to my far right, Chief of my Programs Division, Captain Ken Thompson, to my immediate right, and the Chief of my Budget Division, Captain Dave Spade, to my left. I'm pleased to meet with you and the other distinguished members of this subcommittee to discuss the grounding of the tanker Exxon Valdez and the resulting oil spill in Prince William Sound. I would like to summarize my statement, but ask that the full statement be included in the record.
Without objection, and the chair would admonish all witnesses to follow the example of the Admiral in doing so. Admiral.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, last week after my trip with you to the Gulf was cut short because of this disastrous oil spill, Secretary Skinner, the EPA Director Riley, and I spent 2 days in Alaska getting a first-hand look at the oil spill area and the cleanup activity. Just before we left Alaska, we met with the President in the Oval Office to discuss this tragic situation and receive his instructions. Let me assure you that the President is deeply concerned about the environmental issues and very interested in the Coast Guard's marine safety and environmental protection missions. When we returned, we reported back to the President on our findings. We're getting good cooperation from all of the agencies and parties involved in trying to minimize the potentially devastating effects of the largest oil spill in this nation's history. I am satisfied that this country's National Response Organization is working well, considering the severity of the spill and the remoteness of the area. There is also significant cooperation and effort from the state of Alaska and volunteers from environmental groups, fishermen, and the local public in general. The federal on-scene coordinator for the cleanup operation is Coast Guard Commander Steve McCall, the captain of the Port of Valdez. He is being advised by leading marine environmental and pollution experts representing all of the agencies and parties involved. Exxon has assumed full responsibility for cleanup, and their activities are being guided by Commander McCall. Now, I'd like to now take a minute or two and ask Commander Hollingsworth of my staff to brief the committee on the situation with the oil spill as of this morning. Commander Hollingsworth.
Their activities are being guided by Commander McCall. Now, I'd like to now take a minute or two and ask Commander Hollingsworth of my staff to brief the committee on the situation with the oil spill as of this morning. Commander Hollingsworth.
That's quick.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I am Lieutenant Commander Wayne Hollingsworth. I work in the Environmental Response Division.
Commander, you want to speak loudly, or if we can get a mic to him, is that possible?
Should be, huh?
He's wired for sound. The wiring doesn't work. It may be...
I'll speak up. Just after midnight on Friday, March the 24th, the tank ship Exxon Valdez ran aground on Bligh Reef while outbound in Prince William Sound. Valdez located here. The vessel ran aground in this area.
I'll speak up.
11 of the vessel's 16 tanks were reported damaged. 8 of the 11 tanks contained cargo. The vessel was carrying 53 million gallons of Alaska North Slope crude oil. Approximately 10 million gallons was spilled. It's estimated that most of the oil was released into the water within the first 3 or 4 hours after the grounding. Coast Guard Marine Safety Office Valdez is the pre-designated federal on-scene coordinator for this incident. They were notified of the incident at 12:28 a.m. They immediately closed the port and began their federal and state notification process. Coast Guard personnel were aboard the Exxon Valdez within 3 hours after they were notified. They could not fully assess the situation until first light. The regional response team for Alaska was activated, and a teleconference was held late in the morning on the 24th. Dispersant use and burning were discussed as possible supplements to mechanical cleanup. The on-scene coordinator is responsible for overseeing the cleanup operations. In doing this, he must ensure that the cleanup is adequate, timely, and will minimize the damage to the environment. Exxon relieved Alyeska of financial and logistical responsibility at noon on the 24th. The federal government and Exxon have deployed tons of equipment and hundreds of personnel to the scene. Government equipment on scene include 3 Coast Guard cutters, 6 Coast Guard aircraft, 1 NOAA aircraft, 6 Coast Guard portable pumps which were used to offload the Exxon Valdez, 1 Coast Guard open water skimming system, 7 Navy skimmers, and over 36,000 feet of boom. There are 388 Coast Guard personnel on scene and 88 other federal employees on scene. Exxon has contracted for approximately 100 vessels. 28 of these vessels are directly involved in wildlife recovery. 3 barges are on scene to accept the oil recovered by the skimming systems. Exxon has also contracted for 49 aircraft and 12 skimmers. Over 110,000 feet of boom have been deployed, and 35,000 feet of boom are en route. Over 300 people have been employed by Exxon. The response consists of 3 phases. Phase 1, an assessment of Prince William Sound was conducted to determine the cleanup priorities of the impacted areas. Phase 2 is the cleanup. Phase 3 is an evaluation of that cleanup. The cleanup phase of response involves 3 parts. Part 1 was to eliminate the threat of future pollution by offloading Exxon Valdez. Part 2 is to protect sensitive areas by using containment and sorbent boom. Sensitive areas such as the hatcheries in Esther Bay, Main Bay, Eshimi Bay, and in Sawmill Bay. Part 2 is to protect sensitive areas. Part 3 of the cleanup phase is the actual cleanup, and that will be the most labor and time intensive part. 3 vessels were used to offload the Exxon Valdez. Offloading began March the 25th and was completed April the 4th. Coast Guard strike team personnel supervised the offloading, 10 portable pumps were used in the operation. Six of these 10 were provided by the Coast Guard strike team. The vessel was refloated on April the 5th and was moved to the west of Naked Island in this area right here. The vessel is anchored and has been completely boomed. In the operation, six of these 10 actual cleanup is being done mostly using mechanical means. Dispersant and burning have been used on a limited basis. Mechanical recovery has accounted for the removal of over 700,000 gallons of oil. NOAA estimates that approximately 30% of the oil spill has evaporated. The high viscosity of the weathered oil is causing the skimmers to operate at below normal capacity. It's also requiring the skimmers to be cleaned frequently. NOAA estimates that approximately 30% of the oil. I'm going to be referring to the chart and just want to explain that the areas in red indicate heavy concentrations, the areas in green are medium concentrations, and the area in blue are sheens that are on the water. And the dark area along the beach are the areas that are heaviest impact. Throughout the incident, from where the vessel grounded, the oil has primarily moved in a southwesterly direction. That's due in part to the winds that have been prevailing during the time and the fact that the water movement in Prince William Sound generally enters in Hinchinbrook Channel and it exits out Montague Strait. The heaviest concentrations have been on Naked Island, Smith Island, Knight Island, Green Island, and in the area around Evans Island. Skimmers have been operating on the northern side and to the west of Knight Island and around the southern part of Knight Island, as well as in the Sawmill Bay area, which has one of the sensitive hatcheries. Beach cleanup is being conducted on Naked Island and Smith Island. The oil now is flushing into the Gulf of Alaska.
One of the sensitive hatcheries. Beach cleanup is being conducted on Naked Island and Smith Island.
The oil is generally moving in a southwesterly direction. The farthest advance of the oil is a little over 60 miles. There has been some slight impact outside of Prince William Sound in these areas right in here. Let me start by saying Valdez is up in this area. This is Prince William Sound. Kodiak down here.
Is a little over 60 miles. There has been some slight impact.
The Marine Safety Office in Anchorage is pre-planning to ensure that sensitive areas along the Alaskan coastline are being protected. Seward, which is located right here, has deployed boom that has been provided by Exxon and the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard will pre-stage two Coast Guard barrier booms in Homer. They will also pre-stage two barrier booms in Kodiak.
Located right here.
The on-scene coordinator, with the assistance of the regional response team, will continue to directly and closely monitor the response and support actions by Exxon. That concludes my briefing. Admiral?
Thank you very much. That concludes my opening statement, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that the subcommittee may have.
Admiral, thank you very much. News reports this morning indicate that the governor of Alaska has concluded, in his opinion, that Exxon is just too big and bureaucratic to handle this cleanup effort, and is now making another request that the Coast Guard take over the management of the cleanup since it has military command capabilities. Are you prepared to respond to that request, and if so, what is your response?
Well, I think the governor and I are coming, have come to the same basic conclusion. I've discussed this with the Alaska delegation,
and we were in the Oval Office all morning yesterday with the same kind of a discussion. My district commander is now taking on more of the guidance of the spill cleanup than we have heretofore, more direction, and we're going to discuss this further with Exxon and others to best accomplish the cleanup without losing any ground, while taking full advantage of the organization that we have in place, and frankly, taking full advantage of the willingness of Exxon to open their checkbook and fund this cleanup.
Admiral, I know because I was with you when this incident began to break, that you responded before being requested to respond by Exxon in sending equipment to aid in this cleanup. You and I were en route, if you remember, to New Orleans for meetings in New Orleans at the time. And I'm aware, of course, that you have exercised extraordinary concern on behalf of the Coast Guard and its responsibilities here. But the question that this committee will be extremely interested in as we pursue this tragedy to its conclusion is the ability of the Coast Guard, and in fact our federal system, to respond if in fact we had made the choice to federalize this cleanup. Is it a fact that Exxon has more money and more resources than our U.S. Coast Guard? Is it a fact that our oil spill liability fund is so small, so weak, that you are not really faced with the right kinds of options here and that you had to rely upon Exxon to clean up this mess?
Well, some of that is perhaps true. The oil liability fund, the 311K fund, is now down to some $3 or $4 million. We're looking at a $100 million, $200 million spill. We're looking at a corporate giant who has been a good corporate citizen in their response so far, willing to open their checkbook, put no limits on it. I would be very reluctant to federalize this bill with $4 million in my pocket when I know that we're spending over $100 million a day Exxon is. So some of that is certainly true. Also, I'm well aware the Coast Guard has a military organization, a very responsive organization, an operational organization. We need to provide the guidance and the direction to Exxon as we move forward on this thing. Another thing of some interest is that the contracting problem that the federal government, to wit the Coast Guard, would have were we to federalize would be a massive problem. I estimated yesterday that it would take something over 20 or 30 contracting officers alone to go to Alaska to start to supervise these contracts. Now, a corporate entity doesn't have the federal procurement rules, the regulations, all of the problems that you have in the federal government of taking bids, being sure that everybody has a shot at it. You can't just go out and begin to write checks as Exxon can. So I think we need to be very careful as we move towards a full federalization, and it would be a much better thing to do if we could manage this spill using Exxon as the checkbook and that kind of thing. I think we'll do much better at that. By the way, in 1988, we had some 1,600 spills cleaned up. 1,400 of them were by private people, and only less than 200 did we federalize and manage ourselves. This spill is mammoth compared to anything that we've seen so far.
Admiral, recognizing that indeed Exxon is spending, I think, about $1 million a day in the cleanup right now, and that that with the oil spill liability fund at about $3 million, if you were to federalize, you'd last 3 days out there. That raises a big question, and that is that even if our bureaucracy is as bad as Exxon, or perhaps worse, the option was not yours, was it not, to federalize so massive a spill, because we have not provided you with that option?
I would have been very reluctant, all other things being equal, with the fund at $4 million to federalize a spill that I knew was going to go $100 million. Now, we can do that, and there's ways around that, and we could come up here for reprogramming, and we could come up for more money and those kind of things. But you know yourself that sometimes things even take time in this Congress of ours.
Touché, Chef. We have our own little bureaucracy up here. Admiral, before I yield other questions, I'm going to ask you the tough one that other members have asked in opening statements. How is it that Captain Hazelwood was in command of this vessel? How is that possible under our rules? What's wrong with our rules? What ought we do to change it?
Well, of course, Captain Hazelwood had a license. The responsibility, the requirement to have a license, in addition to being qualified, you submit an application, and on that application, you must list any convictions that you have had prior to this, and that includes anything except minor traffic convictions. We've reviewed the application for renewal of this merchant mariner's license. He did not list the kinds of things that Mrs. Lowy mentioned were in his record. Those things were not listed. Had they been listed, there would have perhaps been a very different result on his ability to renew this license.
Let me interrupt quickly. Yeah. DWI is not a listed offense on the application for renewal of license.
DWI is an included offense in that it asks, have you had any convictions other than minor traffic offenses in the last X number of years, in 5 years? He listed none, when in fact we've heard testimony here in an opening statement, we've seen it in the newspapers, there have been some convictions very recently.
Is the procedures for renewal of license such there is no background check, no computerized search as other computerized searches are often made for criminal records?
There is no computerized routine check unless something on the application keys it. And then there is a check which takes a very long time. Sometimes as much as a year to go through all of the checks you need to go through. But routinely, we do not do that. We take the license and don't. We take the application and we do not look behind the application. Now, we have thousands of applications each year for merchant mariner's license.
One final thing. Are you prepared now to say that you are ready to recommend changes in those procedures? Are you prepared, for example, to recommend mandatory drug testing, as we have recommended for military services? Are you prepared to recommend mandatory computer checks of criminal records? Are you prepared to make any other recommendations that would have prevented this man from being at the helm of this ship?
Well, let me say that we have drug testing required now. Before you can apply for a license, you must take a drug test, a urinalysis test. That's routine. That's done. There's also regulations on the street that are being commented on now that will require random drug testing, and there is drug testing required after any accident. What we're talking about is a drug, an illegal drug. Now, unfortunately, in our society, we do have a legal drug, and that's alcohol. And it that is not illegal to use. The abuse of it is hard to identify. A DWI is one of the ways you identify abuse of it. I'm not sure that is sufficient, but it's very difficult to find a way that's better than looking for DWIs. Somebody who abused alcohol that didn't drive a vehicle at all, never applied for a license, that would not be a way to identify that. So unless he identifies it on his application, or that you can find evidence someplace else that he's an alcohol abuser, very difficult to ring that out.
Thank you, Admiral. I'll now recognize the gentleman from Alaska for questions. Mr. Young.
I will ask not as many questions. I know everybody is very interested in asking their own questions, and we have a lot of people here. There's been accusation that the Congress and the Coast Guard decrease their traffic safety radar coverage in this area because, again, as my opening statement, I think we became very lax. What would it cost to extend the radar and the traffic control system to the outer rim, in fact, all the way to Hinchinbrook, to make sure? And again, I don't care what kind of radar we had. If you got a pilot, if you look at that map, he had to deliberately take a turn to the left and go to the rocks, if there was a pilot on the bridge, by the way. But what would it cost? Will you ask for that from this committee?
Yes, I will furnish that for the record. I don't have it. It was considered when we put in the traffic system, as you remember, Mr. Congressman. We took a look at that when we put it in, and I guess about 1977. I don't have those figures, what it would cost to do that now. Now, when we put it in 77, it was the conventional wisdom that the area was so wide, 10 miles wide where he went aground, and it opens up down to Hinchinbrook, probably to 20 miles wide, that it wouldn't be necessary to have radar coverage of that area any more than it would be in Delaware Bay, Chesapeake Bay, San Francisco Bay, etc. We'll give you that for the record, sir.
I'm going to try to make sure that's done. Again, part of the preventive maintenance, the preventive character, to make sure this doesn't happen again, and this is part of that practice. With the additional taking the pilots, what do you have any feelings about taking the pilots all the way to Hinchinbrook and utilizing someone as what we call an onshore pilot as base there, knows the area, and undoubtedly will be sober. And as a pilot, I speak, you know, sort of a little prejudice there. And would you have any comment on that?
Well, no, I would not oppose that. I would say, however, when we started the system in 1977, we talked very seriously about having pilots get on at Hinchinbrook. What that resulted in was we boarded foreign vessels at Hinchinbrook with state-licensed pilots. We had an accident there. When we started the system in 1977, we talked very seriously about having pilots get on at Hinchinbrook. What that resulted in was we boarded foreign vessels at Hinchinbrook with state-licensed pilots. We had an accident there.